Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
value judgment. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is billing today's federal budget as a commitment to generational fairness. But the conservative finance critic tells us taxpayers might not believe it's fair at all.
Borrowed time. The economist who helped Paul Martin eliminate the deficit tells us Canadians could be paying the price for today's federal budget in harder times than we're facing right now.
Parked life. A dozen people in search of affordable housing spent the long Nova Scotia winter living at a campground in RVs. One resident tells us whether it was home sweet motorhome or hell on wheels.
Culture shock. One of the oldest and most treasured buildings in Copenhagen is engulfed by flames. A witness tells us about the heartbreaking loss and the heartwarming efforts to save the artworks inside.
That's the way the ball bounces. After a stellar college career, Ontario's Aaliyah Edwards is drafted into the WNBA. Her former coach tells us that was a slam dunk, and she hopes it will inspire young players to dream big.
And getting to the root of the problem. Fed up with tourists crowding their transit, residents of one Barcelona neighborhood come up with an ingenious plan. Simply hide the bus route by removing it from Google Maps. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that pulls out all the stops. Christia Freeland says today's federal budget is about fairness, although that claim is proving fairly divisive. For the past while, the finance minister and her colleagues have been making announcements about what the budget would deliver for Canadians. And this afternoon, she explained how exactly all the spending and all the cutting is going to work out.
We are moving with purpose to help build more homes faster. We are making life cost less. We're driving the kind of economic growth that will ensure every generation of Canadians can reach their full potential. And we're making Canada's tax system more fair by ensuring that the very wealthiest pay their fair share.
That was Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland this afternoon. Jasraj Singh Hallan is the Conservative finance critic. We reached him in Ottawa.
Jasraj Singh Hallan, there was laughter there as the finance minister spoke. Why that laughter?
Well, first of all, let me just say that we had asked Justin Trudeau to stop this morning. We told him to stop his deficit, stop the inflation, stop his tax hikes. Yet today, in this photo op budget, he sped right through that stop sign and poured $40 billion of fuel on the inflationary fire that he started.
I saw Pierre Poilievre, the Conservative leader's press conference, where he made similar statements, and I understand the need for slogans from where you stand. But in terms of actual answers to what Canadians need, why is what you heard there a concern?
Because this government continues to prove why they have not made life more affordable for Canadians. On April the 1st, they played a very cruel April Fool's Day joke and added 23% onto their carbon tax scam, making the cost of gas, groceries, and home heating even more expensive. They raised alcohol taxes. They've rolled payroll taxes. They've done nothing but make life more and more unaffordable. After pouring $600 billion of debt onto taxpayers, what that did was drive up interest rates at the fastest rate in Canadian history, putting Canadians most at risk in the G7 for a mortgage default crisis. after committing.
Let me just say, let me jump in there for a second because we are limited on time, sir. The Canadian housing economist Mike Moffitt told CBC News today the government's push for density in cities will, quote, help build more homes. He said changes to the tax rules for the construction of apartment units mean, quote, we'll get hundreds of thousands of more apartment units built, end quote. What do you say to Canadians who think more homes and apartments sound like a great idea right now?
And that's exactly what it is. It's just an idea. It's a wish list. After committing $89 billion into housing, guess what happened? Housing cost doubled in this country. Mortgages have doubled because of the inflationary spending, and rents have doubled. And now it takes double the amount to save for a down payment on a house. You used to be able to pay off a mortgage in 25 years. Now it takes 25 years to save up for a down payment on a house. This is after 8 years. And by the way, this is the ninth inflationary budget after Justin Trudeau said that budgets balance themselves.
What would you do differently if a conservative government were in power and you were presenting this budget today in these circumstances?
We would axe the tax. We would get rid of the carbon tax to bring down the cost of gas, groceries, and home heating, and also pass Bill C-234 today, if it under the current government, to bring down the cost for our farmers and food. Number two, we would bring in a dollar-for-dollar law to cap the spending. What that we've seen that very successful plan unfold in the U.S. under Bill Clinton's administration that helped balance the budget. What by balancing the budget, we could control inflation, lower interest rates so Canadians can stay in their homes. Number three, we want to build more homes, not more bureaucracy. Our common-sense conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, the next prime minister, has tabled this bill in Parliament that would incentivize municipalities to close 15% more permits for home building. What that would do is increase the supply. As a former home builder, I've seen lots of red tape and bureaucracy when it comes to municipalities. This would incentivize them, and municipalities would have to act like realtors, that they would have to meet that target. The municipalities that don't, we would withhold their infrastructure dollars. The ones that do and exceed that target would get infrastructure dollars and a bonus if they exceed that target.
What would you say, sir? You know, we've had a lot of conversations on this program about people forced to live in tent cities. Or later in the show, they will hear from a man who spent the winter living in an RV with, other RVs around him, other people, because his rent skyrocketed. He has a job, a steady job, good work. He's single. He doesn't have multiple mouths to feed, and he can't make ends meet. So he had to go the route of living in an RV. So people are desperate for affordable housing. This is offering a plan. Whether they fulfill these promises or not, I can't say, but this is offering a plan along those lines.
The examples you give are precisely why, after 8 years of Justin Trudeau, he is not worth the cost. This is after committing $89 billion to housing, and Canadians are worse off than they've ever been. What we need is a common-sense conservative government under Pierre Poilievre that will, number one, axe the tax, will get rid of the carbon tax to bring down the cost of gas, groceries, and home heating. And by the way, the Bank of Canada's governor confirmed that a big chunk of the overall inflation number that went up today can be taken off immediately overnight if we axe the tax, which means he could work on getting the interest rate down faster.
Statistics Canada released Canada's March inflation numbers today. As you well know, inflation was under 3%. That's for the third month in a row now. Grocery inflation is back under 2% after, hitting that really difficult 11% peak. So there is change, and it's shifting in a better direction.
There was change. Today, inflation went up. I think you failed to mention that. Also, on top of that, continuing on, it's well above the target rate. That is why they had to hold the rates once again. There is much pain out there because of Justin Trudeau's spending, and the governor of the Bank of Canada confirmed that Justin Trudeau's spending is what's blocking the way of him lowering interest rates. So we would number, and to continue on, our second plan is to build the homes. Like I said, we want to incentivize municipalities to build by getting them to have 15% more permits. Number three, fix the budget. Precisely why we're in the mess we're in today after 8 years of Justin Trudeau. We need to fix the budget and bring in that dollar for dollar law so we can bring down inflation, bring down interest rates, keep Canadians in their homes.
Jasraj Singh Halland, we have to leave it there for time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jasraj Singh Holland is the conservative finance critic. We reached him in Ottawa. For four centuries, the old stock exchange in Copenhagen has stood as a testament to Danish culture and ingenuity. But today, the city is heartbroken after the building went up in flames and its iconic spire toppled down. The building was under construction when the fire started. Authorities say it has been contained, but that pockets of fire remain inside. No one was hurt, but people across Denmark are lamenting the loss of the building, which has been described as Denmark's Notre Dame. Søren Larsen is a reporter with the Danish Broadcasting Corporation. We reached him in Copenhagen earlier today.
Søren, what does the site look like right now?
Two firemen is on each side of the building. They have been pouring water over the building for 12 hours now. There's smog all over the inner city of Copenhagen. Ash is falling down. And there'll still be around 100 people at work, from the fire department, from the police, from the media.
So it's still an active scene. I mean, they have it under control, but it's by no means...
They have it under control, yeah. But it's still burning in there.
Yeah. If we go back to this morning, when did you first arrive on site?
I arrived on site 10 or 20 minutes past 8.
Yeah.
At that time, there was a really bizarre scene because everyone could see there was a fire going on. But the weird thing was that there was people running in and out of the building, and it was obvious people who didn't came from the fire department, they didn't came from the police. It was people just stopping by, people running in, people were, you could tell they were chefs, they were painters, they were carpenters, they did every other thing that taking care of a fire. And what they came out with was paintings and valuable belongings to this building and to the city, to Copenhagen, to Denmark. It was really bizarre. Like, people were doing everything they could to help and to rush into that building to save what was in there to be saved.
Were they able to save much of what was in there, the artifacts, the cultural objects, the paintings?
We still don't know how much they were able to collect. But I have seen, and I've been covering during the day, what we have seen was that they have saved a lot of different paintings that are around 200-300 years old, valuable belongings to Denmark. So it's it's been a very bizarre sight and a very bizarre thing to be a part of today.
Yeah. And did you arrive at the site because you had heard what was happening, or were you just making your way somewhere else and saw it?
The funny thing that my office, I worked in the Danish Parliament as a political reporter, and the Danish Parliament is right next to the building. So from my window, I can see straight to that burning building. So I was going there no matter what. But today I was going to covering politics, I thought. But this day has been around all other stuff than politics.
Yeah. Because you can see it out your window, you see what it's like every day and can sort of offer a sense of what it means to you. What did that spire mean to you?
I'm not sure what it means to me yet. I'll figure it out the next couple of days, but it means a lot to Copenhagen as a city, because it's a site where every tourist who's coming to Copenhagen, they would see that site. If you go on a canal tour, if you're going on a guided tour, on a bus tour, you will see that building. The building is more than 400 years old, and it's one of the absolutely most iconic buildings of Copenhagen. Yeah, it's a national site. It's a site of our capital. And that's what we don't have anymore, because what I'm looking at now is a building which is not there anymore, at least half of it.
No one was hurt, as far as I know. No one was killed. So in a terrible scenario, that is the best case, I think we can say. But what are the questions that people there are asking about what happened? We know the building was under renovation. It's covered in scaffolding.
Yeah, the thing is that the building was under reconstruction, and it's been for quite a while, because it's such an old building, and later this year, there was supposed to be a huge party where everyone was invited to see the king was coming, the prime minister was coming, to celebrate that this building was like built 400 years ago, and now it's not there anymore. So what people are asking is whether it was this construction or reconstruction that led to this fire, but it's still too early to say. It's still burning. So yeah, the police haven't even been on the site yet. They're outside trying not to get too close, because we have to remember that this building is still burning.
It is early, as you say. The building is still burning. Is there a discussion underway yet about rebuilding that spire to look at least like it did?
That question has already been answered, because the mayor of Copenhagen have already said that no matter what, they will rebuild this iconic site in Denmark. No matter how much it's going to cost, no matter what, they will try to restore. You cannot have the historical building back, but what you can do is you can rebuild and try to rebuild what once were. And she promised that today, and everyone around has been like cheering on that, because today Copenhagen and Denmark lost a really iconic building.
Yeah, I saw some photographs. People, you know, adults getting emotional looking at this.
Yeah,
were you surprised to see that depth of emotion?
No, really not. You know, in London they got Big Ben. I don't know what you have in Canada, but if you have really huge sites, which is on every poster of your biggest city, you have like emotions of that. Even though it's just a building, it's something that belongs to Copenhagen and what you know Copenhagen is proud of. So if you have a poster of the 10 most iconic building in Copenhagen, then this building would be one of them.
Søren, I appreciate your time.
Of course.
Take care.
Bye.
Søren Larsen is a reporter with Denmark's public broadcaster, DR. We reached him in Copenhagen earlier today.
With the sixth pick in the 2024 WNBA draft, the Washington Mystics select Aliyah Edwards, University of Connecticut.
The sound last night as Kingston, Ontario's Aliyah Edwards was drafted into the WNBA. The 6'3" forward is coming off a stellar college basketball career, having reached the Final Four with the University of Connecticut Huskies three times, including last month when they lost in the semis. Here's how Ms. Edwards reacted right after the draft.
Whew, I can take a breath now. Oh my gosh. It's amazing. It's a dream come true. And to actually walk your dream, it means a lot.
That dream was fostered in the gym at Kingston, Ontario's Frontenac Secondary School, where she played ball. And the dream is coming true as a new generation of players, including Ms. Edwards, Caitlin Clark, and Angel Reese, are taking women's basketball to a whole new level. Carlin Pixley is the athletic director at Frontenac Secondary and Aliyah Edwards' former coach. We reached her in Kingston, Ontario.
Carlin, she took a breath. She got emotional. How could she not? Did you get emotional as you watched that moment?
I did. It's so exciting. Like, when you see Aliyah play and you know her personally, you know the time and the effort that she's put into herself and her teammates and really anything she does. And when she said it was time to take a breath and then the emotions came, I just thought she can finally relax and enjoy her basketball career, because I remember in grade 9 asking her, like, what is your end goal? Where are we going here? Yeah. And she said, with a little smile, I want to play in the WNBA. And I just thought she made it.
Yeah. Did you ever doubt it? You know, a lot of young people have big dreams, as they should. But did you ever question it with her, or did you know that this was going to happen for her?
No, it's like as soon as she walked into the building, we knew that Aaliyah was special. And with her family behind her, we knew that she would do great things. And we always hoped that her dreams would come true, because if anybody deserves it, she does.
Oh, that's great to hear. And it's emotional just as someone who doesn't know her like you do to watch as well. A lot of who she is seemed to come through naturally in those moments last night. You mentioned her family behind her. Her mother was part of her coaching team to get her to this point. You had a chance to speak with her, right?
Yes, I sent her mom a message this morning just saying how great it was to see Aaliyah on such a stage last night. And in true Aaliyah fashion, she stood and applauded every single player that was chosen before her. And I just said, she's just such a class act. And her mom just quickly texted back and just said, thank you for the note. And Aaliyah makes it easy to be parents.
Ugh, they sound like a great bunch, honestly. And just she hugged everybody there before she went up as well. What about the students at the school? How are they reacting?
Well, I think everybody's a little bit in shock still, and the girls' basketball program here has definitely been following Aaliyah all the way through, and there was a bit of a buzz, like, did you watch it? Are you going to watch it? Who are you watching it with? Did you see, like, all of the group chats were on fire last night talking about the first pick and what they were wearing, and just the excitement is definitely growing.
Well, all of the attention around it to, you know, the fact that the 14 million viewers watched, you know, the semifinals, designers outfitting a lot of these top-ranked players. There's a profile and prominence that many sports fans, specifically fans of women's sports, have wanted to see that kind of recognition for a long time. But it was quite moving to see that pinnacle as well hit.
Yeah, these women deserve every recognition that they are getting, the time and effort that they've put in. It's so nice to see them rewarded and be treated like the stars they are. Yeah, I think their personalities definitely show in everything that they do, from what they wear to how they speak at the press conferences. And they're really hitting home to a lot of the viewers. And I think that that's what's drawing so much attention, is that they are real people doing really great things.
You know, you mentioned as soon as she walked in all those years ago, you knew she was different, you knew she was special, and everybody did. It was interesting to hear the announcers, you know, saying she already knows how to be a pro, consistency and excellence. You know, what was it about her play and how she carried herself, even all those years ago, that told you this is a star in the making?
Yeah, she's just so poised and confident, but humble at the same time, and there's a real family aspect to everything that Aaliyah does, and just the idea that things may not go her way, and we've seen that in the games that she plays, but she doesn't get down on herself, and she's looking to improve, and she's looking to make the right adjustments, and she was willing to put effort into every part.
Yeah, the hard work.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Like, I would see her running around the neighborhood after practice, and I just thought she understands what she needs to do, and the little bit of extra will pay off.
You mentioned her connection to you still, but also to the school. She's been back recently as well, right?
Yeah, so this past summer she ran Who's Got Next basketball camp here at the school, and she just wanted people to play basketball. She didn't care the age, she didn't care gender, it was just, how many kids can we get in the gym, and can we just get them to play and have fun?
Yeah, this you know, for women's sports does feel like a turning point.
Yeah.
What will you tell players that you're coaching? I mean, do you imagine a time for them where there's equal stardom, equal pay?
I hope so. You know, we're going in the right direction for sure, and I think all of the women that have been showcased throughout the draft and the NCAA, like, do such great things for their communities. And that whole idea of the young girl who's looking up for somebody to be their role model, Aaliyah has been that and will continue to be that for young girls. And there's so many others out there that I think it will just naturally grow and they're household names now.
Carlin, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Carlin Pixley teaches phys ed at Frontenac Secondary School in Kingston, Ontario. She's a former basketball coach of Aaliyah Edwards, who was just drafted into the WNBA. We reached Ms. Pixley in Kingston, Ontario. A stranger walks by your place and notices your garden gnome. "Hey, who's this little guy?" he shouts. Before you can answer, he says, "I call him Bilbo." And off he goes. You don't even have a chance to tell him the gnome's name is Gary. But a few days later, the stranger comes back with someone else. "Brought a chum to meet Bilbo," he shouts. And he keeps coming back, with more and more people who take selfies with your gnome while you hide inside. You must take bold action. So you remove the number from the front of your house. And when the guy shows up the next day with a couple dozen people, he's baffled. "There's no number. I can't find the house," he mutters. And they leave you and Gary alone forever. There's only one reason to believe that that ridiculous strategy would work. And that reason is the number 116 bus in the La Salut neighborhood of Barcelona. But disembodied voice, you say, "I just checked Google Maps and Apple Maps, and there is no number 116 bus in that neighborhood." Well, that bus route does exist. It's just that it was always jam-packed with tourists heading to the popular Parc Güell. So the locals got fed up, and their city council did something hilarious. The council had the number 116 bus route removed from Google Maps and Apple Maps. You won't find it on your phone or your laptop, and neither could tourists in Barcelona. So they found other ways to get to the park, and the locals got their bus back. One activist told The Guardian, "We laughed at the idea at first, but we're amazed that the measure has been so effective. And we're amazed, too. It seemed so silly and sort of selfish, but sometimes you do have to act in your own bust interests."
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Chrystia Freeland says her government's books are in order. As you've been hearing for a few hours now, the finance minister delivered the federal government's budget today. After weeks of spending announcements, it was time to explain how everything would eventually balance out. And Minister Freeland says she's confident it will, thanks to a jump in government revenues and new taxes on top earners. But not everyone is convinced that Minister Freeland has found the right balance. Don Drummond is a former TD Bank chief economist and a former federal finance official who helped put together Paul Martin's deficit eliminating budgets in the 1990s. We reached him in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Don Drummond, you've been known, along with the C.D. Howe Institute, to grade federal budgets. What grade would you give this one?
Well, there's two keys that are beside each other in the keyboard of my fingers keeps hovering. At best, it's a D, but F is right beside it. Just a lot of spending. I'll talk about the tax measure in it. I actually thought, given the lead up, there were going to be more tax gimmicks in it. So maybe I might go a little bit to the left on a D, but wow. Not very good. Lots of deficits, lots of debt, tons and tons of spending.
The finance minister says government revenues are higher than expected. She's going to pull, she says, in an extra $22 billion over 5 years from higher capital gains taxes and an excise tax on vaping and cigarettes. Why are you concerned?
Well, it's really a conditioning exercise. For the last couple of budgets and the statements, it's kept putting out higher and higher deficits and higher debt loads. And then it says, well, our objective is to do better than that. But that's just beating your own terrible mark. So we already had the deficits hovering around $40 billion and going down to $18 billion way out there in the future in the fall economic statement just before Christmas. And now the objective announced in this budget is to do no worse than that. And it basically keeps the debt-to-GDP ratio. It says it's declining, but it's going from 40% to 39.1%. Yes, mathematically that is declining, but the deficits as far out as the end of this decade are still $20 billion. That's even higher than the fall economic statement. The economy now and then is projected to be around a normal level of activity, witness the relatively low level of the unemployment rate, witness the inflation pressures. There's no reason to have any deficit at all.
We are in an extraordinary time, as you well know. They care maybe what economists think, but they care more what people at home who cannot afford their groceries or childcare or homes. So she's saying that this is about investments in generational fairness. We heard a clip from her earlier where she says we're making life cost less. You know, why shouldn't the government be spending now to make a better life seem possible Gen Z Canadians that they're hoping to
for
reach?
Precisely that reason of generational fairness. This is not money appearing magically. This is money that's borrowed and it has to be repaid in the future. The generation of young people today will have to devote all their resources to deal most likely with climate change adaptation rather than mitigation, but some mitigation as well. And as well, they're being passed off this 40% of relative to the size of the economy debt load to handle with. So it is just a future tax liability coming up. That is really unfair to young people and to the generation that will come after that.
But in terms of where they are right now, in terms of needing homes and jobs, what could the government say to them if not to say we're going to build more homes and make life more affordable? Whether they deliver on it or not and these promises, that's another question. But what would you say differently to young people?
Well, in two respects, the government was part of the reason why we've had these difficulties with the affordability. If we talk about the housing market, I mean, everything is demand and supply. We have had an unprecedented, back to 1956, we have not had as large a percentage increase in Canada's population since 1956, and that was the height of the baby boomers being born and the refugees from Hungary and other Eastern European countries. We haven't seen anything like that at all until we had 2023. So that's increased the demand for housing enormously. And with all the spending, of course, that's been adding to economic activity and adding to pressures against the inflation target as well. So, yeah, it's fine to say the government is trying to do something to mitigate that, but they've been a primary catalyst for those inflation pressures as well.
Where would you find the money to eat into the deficit?
Well, they'd have to find it internally. The spending is really, really high, and you can get it. And it's obviously they've lost their interest in the internal spending. With the slightest of fanfare possibly, there's a little note in the public and the main estimates that were released on February 29th that said if you wanted to know what happened to the first round of the program review conducted by the president of the Treasury Board, you have to look through thousands of pages of documents under each department. They didn't even bother to add it up. I assume they decided there wasn't really anything worthwhile adding up. The second part of the review is just we're going to rely on attrition, as opposed to something way back in 1995 where every single cent of government activities was evaluated and a lot of the activities were stopped. That's how you generate internal savings. There's not an appetite for that. That's more of an attitude right now, let's spend money, and of course we'll borrow to do that. As you noted at the outset, they've had somewhat good fortune that the projections of the level of nominal activity, largely because of higher than expected inflation, has gone up. That will raise revenue. So that's giving them a couple of $1 billion. And then they put in this $19 billion over 5 years from the capital gains measure. I have my doubts about that. You'll probably get quite a bit of revenue before June 24th when the new measure kicks in, because anybody who's sitting on an unrealized capital gain will want to realize it before then. That's going to create some real havoc on the stock market.
In a couple of minutes, our listeners are going to hear, Don, from a man in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, who's one of many people living in RVs. They spent the winter in their RVs because they can't make ends meet and because they've been renovicted and dealing with what a lot of Canadians are dealing. When you hear tent cities and RV, you know, RV camps, people trying to do what they can, again, what would make this an A budget to you that would also help Canadians?
We would be planning for the longer term. This is just a patchwork. It will help some affordability, but we've done this before. We built up these big deficits in the 1980s, and we had to reconcile that in the 1990s. We went to excesses in the housing markets, and that created the financial crisis and the like. We're trying to get a steadier pattern going to the economy so you don't go through these cycles. And heading up all this debt and adding all these demand pressures is just setting up another cycle. It's reckless to be running these deficits and these great big debt, and there'll be a price to pay for it, as there always has been in the past.
Don Drummond, thank you for your time.
Okay, you're welcome.
Don Drummond is a former TD Bank chief economist. He's currently a fellow in residence at the C.D. Howe Institute. We reached him in Scottsdale, Arizona. When the Toronto Raptors lost to the Miami Heat on Sunday, it officially concluded a season that had unofficially concluded a while ago. The team fell short of making the playoffs again after a year of change that saw championship-era fan favorites like Pascal Siakam and OG Anunoby traded. Understandably, Darko Rajakovic is looking forward. The team's head coach spoke at an end-of-season press conference today and shared his plans for the off-season.
My first part of my development is to get some sleep. That's number one, and then I kind of like have every season I have my own way of preparing. I like to watch different teams, different leagues. I like always to catch up to see on some new tendencies in the basketball world. I like to read books. I like to work on myself as a leader, what I can do better. I have a list of stuff that, you know, during the course of the season I'm thinking about. And because of the nature of business, I don't have enough time to address that during the regular season. Now in off season, there is going to be more time for me to reflect and to learn and to be better prepared to handle different situations ahead of me.
What did you learn about yourself as a coach during the season?
You know, for pretty much my whole career, I was always coaching teams that had positive records and winning and competing to win championships and all of that. Actually, as a head coach, I had only one losing season, and that was my second year in the G League. And I think what I learned about myself is just that ability to keep the big picture, you know, in the first plan. It's not easy to lose, and it's not easy to stay on the sideline. And you saw me, Doug, standing with our guys until the last second of the last game. And that's how I operate. I really believe in our guys, and I'm going to pour everything into them. What I really learned there is importance of keeping the big picture and main thing the main thing.
That was Toronto Raptors head coach Darko Rajakovic speaking to the media today. Nova Scotia gets chilly in the winter. It's often hit by storms that have people hunkering down and digging out. So you might not relish the idea of living through the cold, dark months in an RV. But that's what a dozen people in Dartmouth did this winter. Because of the spike in housing prices, they couldn't afford to buy or rent. So a pilot project allowed 12 people to set up RVs at the Shuby campground. Jeremy Vanden Einden was one of them. He's a metal fabricator by trade. We reached him at the campsite in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia.
Jeremy, what did people say when you told them that you're going to be spending the winter in an RV at this campground?
They said I was crazy. They were concerned for my welfare, concerned I was going to freeze. I didn't think I was going to be able to cook a warm meal. So a lot of friends and family, you know, they would ask questions, you know, if I needed to have a shower or if I needed a hot meal, and just worried that I was freezing in here.
And how did it turn out? How did the winter go? How did you do all of those things?
Completely opposite. I kept around 25 degrees in here, actually, pretty much all winter long. So it was quite warm. My RV is fully loaded with a full kitchen and full bath. So I have everything I need there. I can cook and clean and shower. So I've had everything I need here. It's basically just a tiny home on wheels.
There are site fees and service fees at the campground. What do you pay and what does that include?
We're at a cut rate here at $250 a month right now. That comes to $287.50 a month for the rent. And that includes our pump out. So they have a pump truck come here and they pump out our waste tanks. And we have a water truck that comes in and fills up our water tanks once a week.
And what about everything else you need? How far away is this site?
It's pretty centrally located here in the city. You walk out to the main road, there's a bus stop right there. Grocery store's not even a five-minute drive away. I can actually walk across, take trail down and go across the Shubie Canal. And I'm at a major shopping center. That's about a 15-minute walk away. So everything is pretty handy to us here. I was actually more surprised how it was going to be living with a dog and two cats in a tiny RV, which actually went really well. It was a lot better than I expected that was going to go.
There's a community there that you've spoken about. Just tell me what that was like.
We've all become very good friends. We've helped each other out through the winter months here. The lady beside me here, she's on a disability. There's an elderly woman across from me and a younger lady who does work. The elderly lady, I would shovel out her area there, and she would give me like a box of tea or something like that for helping her. So we'd all look out for each other. We'd all help each other here during the winter months.
How did you make the decision? Why did you feel you had to make the decision to live in an RV?
So I spent most of last year fighting a rent eviction, and that kind of came to a head, and I needed a place to go. And with the cost of living here now, the average apartment is about $2,000 a month for a one-bedroom, which is just not financially possible for me, really. That's over half my monthly income. So I caught wind of this happening, and I had already bought the RV a few months prior and just kind of jumped on it and ended up here.
And when you talk about your salary and what your rent jumped up to, what was it before? Because I think your experience would surprise people maybe in other parts of the country.
Yes. So I had lived in my apartment for 8 years. I had moved in to it in 2015 when I took on a new job here and was paying $695 a month rent at that time. With our 2% increases annually here, it was a 2% cap. We were at $790 last year when I left. My old unit is now currently renting for $1,990 a month, nothing included, and an extra $100 for the parking, which was included in my prior rent.
So a good job, steady job, no kids, single guy with a couple of pets. Is this the trajectory you saw yourself on in terms of your housing
absolutely
situation?
Not. Yeah. Absolutely not. I figured another 3-4 years or so at the apartment, continue to save and put down payment on a home, which has also become quite unattainable as well.
This is a pilot project, as you well know. You know, you've had a good experience. Others have said the same. Is it, though, just a Band-Aid solution to a much bigger problem? I mean, do you want to keep living in an RV?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite an acceptable way to live. There's lots of people that are very happy with mm-hmm. it. I'm quite comfortable, but in all reality, I would like to have a couple acres of land and a nice little mobile home and something to that effect. But, you know, I'm 45 years old, and anything like that is now minimum $200,000, so it's going to be a pretty hefty mortgage. So it's become more of a necessity. It was never a dream to live in a motorhome, but at the same time, it's not bad. It's quite comfortable.
It is budget day, federal budget day in this country, as you likely know. you know, and the government has said housing is a priority because there is a housing crisis in this country. What would you like to hear and see in the budget?
Well, I would like to see politicians have a better understanding of what's actually affordable. They are building lots of new apartment rentals here, lots of buildings going up. And our government keeps saying they're building more affordable housing. And then these affordable housings end up with a $2,000 rent. And I'm like, do these politicians believe that $2,000 a month is affordable? Because to me, I mean, I would consider myself a middle class wage earner. And that's not affordable to me. So how would someone working at, say, Walmart or a grocery store be able to afford a $2,000 a month apartment if I can't?
You and the others at the site are going to have to move out in a few weeks. What are your plans?
Most here are going to be heading to seasonal campsites. I may do the same. I have been thinking about maybe moving back out to Alberta, where it's a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more opportunities for full-time RV living out there.
Well, Jeremy, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jeremy Vanden Einden spent the winter living in an RV in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and that's where we reached him. Speaking of winter, if you've ever spent a winter in Newfoundland and Labrador, you'll know that it can feel two or three winters long. And when it stretches into late March and early April, you're about ready to smash your snow shovel into kindling. So it's understandable that Newfoundlanders would want a reward near the end of that stretch. Lots and lots of Newfoundlanders. Recently, a Caribbean cruise ship returned to port with 500 Newfoundlanders on board. It seems they were brought together by some combination of word of mouth, coincidence, and targeted advertising. Pam Pardee and musicians Mark Hiscock and Darren Feehan were all on the ship and had a brief reunion on the St. John's Morning Show today.
For what I understand, it was just a total fluke. Friends of ours and family members booked the trip a year and a half ago, and we were latecomers, so we were just going to go along with our friends and family. And then as it started getting around Christmas, I noticed Mark posted, I think it was a Christmas gift to himself and his wife Kelly, that they were going to be going on the cruise. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we're going too. And then the post started, so am I. So then we knew that this was just a fluke and that it was going to be a rollicking good time.
That is wild. This massive a coincidence, Mark? Pick up on this story. I mean, is your head blown off?
Pretty much. Like, we were the same way. We booked a cruise about a year and a half ago, and we were talking to our travel agent. And she said, there's about 250 couples, roughly, and, you know, a lot. There's going to be about 500 on the cruise. She said, are you bringing your accordion? I said, that's what I am not. I'm going down to relax.
You did sing, though. You did sing.
I did sing a couple of songs on the night that we did. The second night there, we had a gathering up on the pool deck.
Darren, maybe you pick up that part of the story. What happened then when you get 500 Newfoundlanders together on the deck of a cruise ship?
You got a lot of conversations, a lot of connections. It was just like running into old friends. It was like going to almost like a high school reunion.
There was a couple of people going around playing spoons, Mark. I don't know if you saw that as well.
Yes, on the second night when we had our gathering up on the pool deck, they asked me to sing the Islander, of course. So I sing the Islander. Next thing I heard, clickety click 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 click. I said, "Who's playing the spoons out there?" And there was a lady down in the back, and she was giving her.
Yeah. That is amazing. And I suppose everybody, what was it like to come back? I guess you all come back to reality with company at least, right?
You always got to come back to reality.
And now we have a weather warning.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
But how will you remember this now? I mean, it sounds like it's the start of good things to come, Pam.
We didn't know going into it when we heard how many Newfoundlanders there would be, if this was going to be something where you're going to want to hide away or just be out and have a grand time. But I'm glad we embraced it.
Pam Pardee, Mark Hiscock, and Darren Feehan were among 500 Newfoundlanders aboard a Caribbean cruise ship last week. They are speaking with Chrissy Holmes, host of the St. John's Morning Show. Prescription painkillers are a very, very big business in North America. And in the U.S., class action settlements over the ensuing opioid epidemic have become a big business, too. State governments are currently in the midst of processing some $50 billion in payouts from opioid-related lawsuits, including $26 billion awarded as part of a national settlement with manufacturer Johnson & Johnson and three drug wholesalers. But Canada pales in comparison. Not in terms of opioid use. We're easily the world's second biggest prescriber of the drugs, but in terms of legal action against those responsible for the harms they've wrought. Margot Siminovich is hoping to change that. She's one of the lawyers behind a newly authorized class action against 16 pharmaceutical companies involved in manufacturing and distributing opioids in Quebec. We reached her in Montreal.
Margot, what makes this suit different from all of the other attempts to pursue pharmaceutical companies for opioid-related harms in this country, here in Canada?
This suit, like many of them, have taken on a number of pharmaceutical entities, but what's significant is that this class action has actually been authorized. And it's very, very important because we have one class representative who has taken a number of opioid drugs, but not drugs manufactured by each of the defendants. And in our class action, the judge has said that that is sufficient. He has standing to represent all class members. So that makes it a much easier process than other jurisdictions where you might have to find a plaintiff that's taken each defendant's product. But in Quebec, the legislators tried to facilitate class actions for the purpose of giving access to justice for people who would not have it otherwise.
And what's the range of drugs this deals with?
It's very significant. It's everything that has a prescription opioid, and the only ones that are carved out from the class action are OxyContin and OxyNeo, which were the subject of a different class action that has been settled on a national basis.
So this is dealing, though, with oxycodone, hydrocodone, hydromorphone, fentanyl, morphine, and codeine. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Right. In terms of Jean-François Bourassa, he's the representative plaintiff in this case.
That's correct.
You tell us a little bit about him?
Yes. His story is a very sad story, but it's also a very typical story. In 2006, he was working as a roofer. It was his own business. He's working in Laurentians, and he was on top of a roof, and he slipped on ice and fell from the roof and had a very, very bad break to his lower leg and ankle. Taken to hospital where he was treated with opioids for his pain, and he was released in a day or two. But he had very serious pain following that, and he ended up going to a pain clinic and was kept on opioids for the next 10 years or so. And as is typical, when you take opioids over time, you become tolerant to it and you need larger and larger doses. And finally, you're still in pain. You can't function. So for someone like Mr. Bourassa, he feels like he lost his chance to be with his young family. It was very, very difficult for him to work, so he only was able to work on an intermittent basis and eventually had to go on disability. So he just considered the whole thing to be like living in hell. And then eventually he went to try to get treated, and in 2017 was diagnosed with opioid use disorder, and he had severe opioid use disorder.
How is he doing now?
Much better, but, you know, he's on disability, but he feels he's very vindicated by the decision. He feels it's really, really important for him to act on behalf of other victims and to really get the message out that these companies destroy people's lives.
And just to underline, it was a broken leg.
Well, exactly. And actually, the people we talked to had a range of reasons why they were put onto opioids for headaches, for carpal tunnel syndrome, for rheumatoid arthritis. And it's not that pain is not a real problem. It certainly is in our society. But the difficulty is people were not adequately warned of the dangers and risks of taking opioids.
If you were to win this class action, who would be eligible for compensation?
Basically, the class is composed of anyone who's a resident in Quebec who took opioids, were prescribed opioids. The class period is very long. It begins in 1996 and it goes to this year. And you had to be diagnosed with opioid use disorder, or doctors may not have used that term. They might have said he's dependent or she's addicted. But if you fit into the criteria of opioid use disorder and you can have a diagnosis of that, then you're part of the class.
What about people who may not have a formal diagnosis?
They should go to their doctors and see if you can make a historical record of getting prescription opioids, and perhaps they were treated for it, mm-hmm. but they will eventually need some evidence that they had opioid use disorder.
And is there any recourse, Margot, for people who have been harmed by the illicit use of these drugs?
It's going to be a case-by-case basis, and obviously mm-hmm. it will be up to the final judge when there's a trial to draw the line, but we feel that anybody who started with prescription opioids, then got taken off, and by then was addicted, and then went to the street, that they should also be compensated. It's a really common problem.
The national settlement back in 2017 against Purdue Pharma over OxyContin right. and OxyNeo, there was a $20 million payout to thousands of Canadians in that case. But no one, you know, they're small amounts when you break it down. You know, some money may make a difference. But do you think this will be different?
Yes, I really do. I think I don't know why they agreed to $20 million. It seems outrageously small. These drugs destroy people's lives, and $20 million is nothing.
These cases take a long time, as you well know. So the members of this class action, how long do you think they'll have to wait for a resolution?
We are trying to move as quickly as possible. The wheels of justice do sometimes move very slowly. Right now, the first thing is the defendants have 30 days to appeal the decision or to ask for leave to appeal. Presuming that they don't get leave to appeal, then you go into more of the true trial process where they will write a defense. We will ask for discoveries of representatives of the companies to get more evidence. And then you see what happens. You try to settle if you can, but we are very prepared to take this to trial. And we think we have a great case.
Margot, thank you.
No problem whatsoever.
Margot Siminovich is a lawyer with Fishman Flans Milan Paquin LLP in Montreal. That's where we reached her. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.